call the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government to order. We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 5003, which is the budget for the Commission on Black Affairs. We're joined by the Commission as well as LFO. And Steve, why don't you go ahead and start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're scheduled to have public hearings on House Bill 5003 all of this week. This is a bill that contains the budgets of the four advocacy commissions. These commissions are very similar to each other, but I do wish to stress that they are entirely, each one is an independent agency and has its own budget and is not functionally or administratively connected to the other, to any other advocacy commission or to any other state agency. The order of the advocacy commissions that are scheduled for hearing in this subcommittee are today. You'll be looking at the budget of the Commission on Black Affairs. Tomorrow will be the Commission on Asian Affairs. Wednesday, the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And Thursday, the Commission for Women. The commissions, as I said, are similar in what they are charged with doing in statute. And basically, the commissions were set up to assist state government in its efforts to achieve economic, social, legal, and political equality for the populations that they represent. The Commission for Black Affairs is one of these commissions, and I would like to point out a number of things briefly before they start their testimony. First of all, I have distributed to you an item which is described, I think you both see that there, a letter from me to the subcommittee that basically talks about the commission budget and points out some relevant issues related to their funding. One of the immediate things to note, of course, is that after the March 2003 economic forecast came out and showed the state was back in a deficit situation, the 2003 legislature rebalanced the budget, and as one of the elements of that rebalance, funding, general fund support for this commission as well as the other three advocacy commissions was suspended effective April 1st. So there's no general fund available to support these agencies beginning on April 1st through the remainder of this biennium. What you have before you right now is that you are looking at the budget, though, for the 2003-05 biennium. And as you will see, the governor does have a recommendation for restoring or for providing general fund in that biennium. I'll be happy to answer any other questions that you have before the presentation gets started.
Thanks, Steve. I don't have anything to add. We'll go ahead and start with in with the agency then. Is that how you, is that the plan to proceed? All right. I think for the commission, we, Mr. Lake, are you the lead hitter, or is Mr. Rice the lead hitter?
I'm the pitcher, he's the hitter.
All right. Well, let's start the ball game then.
How much time?
You have today, so
today.
This
and I don't know.
Not all
my goodness. Oh, yeah. She knows me. I'm not a consumer.
The center winners was the tied up. I don't know if you had anything to add from what Steve had said. Jackie heard.
Senator Winters apologizes that she was in a meeting with the Senate President and couldn't get down here.
Since she was around when these commissions were set up and involved.
I was responsible under the AT administration for putting together the structure and working on creating the commission, both the Hispanic as well as the Black Affairs Commission, when I was the state ombudsman. And also was around when the Women's Commission was created. I began to feel like I was just around for a lot of things a long time ago. So my history with its creation and its reason for being created goes back to a lot of years, a lot more than sometimes I want to remember, but anyway.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Podges, Senator Winters. Your title says LFO staff?
Yes.
Mr. Bender.
Mr. Bender. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and to speak for the commissions. My name is Johnny Lake. I'm the current sitting chair of the Commission on Black Affairs and have worked with the commission for an extended number of years ever since I've been in Oregon and have been a commissioner. I'm the senior commissioner now, considering the turnover. And presently we are attempting to define the commission so that it can continue to exist despite the current funding concerns. The advocacy commissions were set up for a specific reason. The term advocacy...
That's my fault.
Excuse
me. I forget to.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
No problem.
Thank you. The advocacy, you have these same notes as well I prepared for today. The front lead piece is the primary material I wanted to cover. The advocacy commissions were set up for specific reasons. The term advocacy was and is not a misnomer. Legislators recognized that the least privileged Oregonians were also the least heard and the least represented. It was also wisely recognized that they needed help. Advocacy. Advocacy commissions were created to assist the legislature in meeting its legal responsibilities to the citizens of Oregon. While set up to augment this responsibility, it was never intended or suggested that the commissions would obviate or substitute for appropriate and necessary legislative representation. The commissions do not replace but complement the actions of the responsible legislators to carry out their legal mandates. The various commissions were set up to bring these communities into closer contact with their representatives and to help legislators connect with the ones they work for, the people. With the defunding of the commissions, this aid, this assistance to the legislators to meet their legal responsibility to all Oregonians disappears. A primary question for each legislator as they navigate their difficult task in the Capitol is this. Without the advocacy commissions to assist you, what other steps or actions are you taking to ensure that you meet the legal responsibilities to Oregonians who may be Latino, Asian, female, or African American? The current budget crisis poses a great challenge for our communities and our leaders. It is in such times that true leaders and necessary leadership rises to the occasion. It is not the time to sidestep responsibility or to ignore the complexity of the issues in favor of some false sense of cohesion. We must be honest and willing to make difficult and necessary decisions and changes. We're going to skip if you go to the back page, to the largest paragraph on the page. It is the role and place of government to mitigate and minimize the conflict in our community over resources. The responsibility lies with the government to properly represent all of its citizens, especially the most needy. Many advantages of the most privileged in our society are actually levied against the most needy. The long and historical pattern of fiscal favoritism and discrimination has and continues to have devastating impacts on the most vulnerable communities. We leave the most needy in a downward spiral of despair that creates hopelessness and fear. It is a situation of double jeopardy where failure is planned, expected, and then practically assured. Such second-class treatment is unfair. Leaders must accept their legislative and fiscal responsibility for all citizens, but especially the ones who cannot defend themselves. Andrew Jackson said in 1821, "In general, the great can protect themselves, but the poor and humble require the arm and shield of the law." And the last quote on the page, "The test of our society is not whether we give more to those who already have enough, but whether we give enough to those who have too little." On the next page goes into some of the statistical information respecting the African American community, and it is rather outrageous in terms of the condition of African-American citizens in the state of Oregon compared to white citizens in the state of Oregon. One of the primary characteristics to look at for health issues is the lifespan of the individuals. Black Oregonians die at a median age of 65 years old compared to 76 years old for whites. On a national scale, African Americans have a life expectancy equivalent to that of white Americans in 1960. African-American Oregonians have a higher death rate than white Oregonians in every age category, most pronounced among 35 to 54-year-olds, where blacks have a 2.4 times higher rate. In any given year, black Oregonians face an average 36% greater risk of death than white Oregonians. And the material in there is pretty significant because it gets at the consequences often of dealing with the issues that come with being a minority in a majority community. The infant mortality rates for African-American babies are 3 times the rate for white babies. Homicide is the number one cause of death among 15 to 24-year-old African-Americans. Oregon African-Americans have the highest rates of death due to drug use in the entire United States. African-American deaths in Oregon due to alcoholism are 2.2 times higher than in the rest of the United States. Of the 222 juvenile arrests made for drug violations, 103 were African-American, or equal 46%. Legislators are supporting stiffer sentences for youth rather than implement effective gun control policies in our society. The juvenile crime rate is closely related to the rate of poverty. 15.3 million children lived in poverty in 1992. By race, persons living below the poverty line were white 10%, African American 33%, Latino 17%, other 17%. Child poverty rates in the U.S. are 2 to 9 times higher than those in other major industrialized nations. African Americans living in non-disadvantaged areas do not have higher rates of delinquency than whites living in the same areas. A study in Marion, Lane, and Multnomah counties of Oregon created a disproportionate representation index with a calculation of 1.0 showing overrepresentation. The calculation for African Americans in the three counties ranged from 2.6 to 5.9. The statistics are sobering, and I brought them particularly to reflect the amount of work that is needed in the African-American community in order to build a healthy community for the future. The overrepresentation of African-American children in the dropout suspension rates directly correlates with their overrepresentation in the justice system, which also leads directly into the overrepresentation in the adult prison system. And so in trying to interrupt that cycle, it is essential to work with the children. It's essential to be successful in the communities. Education will interrupt that cycle better than a police officer or better than a jail cell. And so the long-term effect of the work of the Commission on Black Affairs and other efforts to build capacity in the community will pay consequences in the long run. And so the argument for the commissions is that they help the legislatures and the leadership of the community to work with communities that have been distant from the legislature, bringing them closer and helping them to connect with the resources that are available to build capacity in the communities. We are now an integrated community of people where segregation is no longer the model. So it really begs the question, what is happening in the minority communities that preclude them from having the same success as the larger community? If it's not segregation by nature of race, then what is the problem? And should a person, a child in school, be defined by the color of his face? Should I, as a citizen, when I walk into this building, be defined by the color of my face? And should I have to assume that only legislators who look like me represent me? So that if I look at the panel here, then Senator Winters is my representative, but Representative Partridge is not. And so as we move forward into this modern society we are building, I hope that we can structure partnerships that are not simply defined by race, but can be defined by the incredible issues that we face for the future. That education does not come in different colors, and that the success of our children does not depend on addressing simply the issues of their race. I provided some other materials. There's a couple of poems that are my favorites. Langston Hughes was simply incredible in capturing the emotions of the 40s when segregation and integration were the argument. And one of my favorites is I Too Sing America. I Too Sing America. I am the Darker Brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll sit at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am American. And lastly, I provided you a document that I actually developed with some young people about the question of inclusion and exclusion based on race and gender and socioeconomic status, and used some of the documents from the beginning of our society. We too hold these truths to be self-evident, that all, and you, I left that blank. Who are we talking about? All men? In this case, it was only men, because women were not included. Neither were minorities. All men are created equal. What if we put women in there? That all women are created equal. That they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among women. Sounds kind of strange. 47 years ago, our mothers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all women are created equal. So these are the kind of things I think that we are still attempting to address, because we see these issues defined along the lines of race, gender, socioeconomic condition. And I think as we continue to move forward, these issues will improve, but I think that the place of commissions and add additional efforts to address the issues of these communities will be required until we can read these documents without that kind of inclusion and exclusion. It should be citizen of our community.
I have a question.
Thank you.
Mr. Lake, there was some discussion back in the 80s when the commissions was created, whether or not the commission should be one commission that addressed the problems and not separate commissions, so that they were divisive and constantly trying to go after the small piece of pie. And as I hear you talking and your words, it kind of brought that back to me, because what you're saying is that you're still having the same struggles. Do you think that perhaps that a body that is addressing issues collectively would be more better than one that is divided up? And I'm thinking of the commissions themselves, because you mentioned all the various individuals, and it seems to me that if there's problems that have to do with economics, if there's problems that have to do with housing, if there's problems that have to, you know, that you're all saying the same thing. So I'd just like your comments on that particular issue.
Well, I've been extremely fortunate since I came to Oregon. I grew up in Tennessee, where the cultures were black and white. And they were the same cultures, because white Southerners are just like black Southerners. They talk the same, they walk the same, they eat the same foods. Many ways, not much cultural variance. Here in Oregon, I presently work with the Native American community extensively in leadership with their young people and also with their tribal administrations. I work with the Latino community extensively. I work with Asian communities extensively. I work with the poor white communities in the rural areas extensively. What I find is that the issues are different, as if individuals, each community is considered as an individual, so that the articulation of a certain issue to a native tribe may resonate and be meaningful. You take that same issue into the Latino community, and it does not strike any iron. You take the Latino community's issues, and they are extremely powerful and motivating for that community. You mention those to Native Americans, they don't get what you're talking about. And so the ability to work with these different communities, I think, is really important in cultural competence in dealing with the issues of each community. So I find the commissions not necessarily divisive or against each other, but peculiarly suited to meet the needs of the communities as they exist currently in Oregon, because the issues do not necessarily cross-reference culture to culture.
Mr. Chair, then my next question is, it has been 23 years since the commission was created, what changes have occurred as a result of the work of the commission?
Well, the commissions, as I have operated with them, not for 23 years, you probably know the history better than I do, but probably half that time that I've worked with them, the commission that I'm familiar with most is the Black Commission. I can speak for that one, and worked some with the Latino Commission. But they've struggled to define their role and their place in the context of this Oregon. They have struggled in making a persona that was recognized in the communities and connected with the communities at the same time that they maintained a viable connection with the legislatures. In fact, that has been oftentimes a conflicted position. To speak up for the communities in the context of the legislature has often been discouraged. And so what the communities have found is that the commissions...
Could you expound on that, of why there is that conflict? Or why there is that problem?
Well, I can state specifically in terms of education, the incredible dropout and suspension rate for African-American children have been brought directly to the commission. And the commission has hesitated to raise these issues in the context of the larger legislature because of the caution that legislators would be upset that this would cause a problem for the commission. In fact, there's a newspaper editorial, I meant to bring it for you, that detailed one of those conversations we had in the commission meeting about raising these issues respecting the condition of African Americans.
So how do you think I guess to some degree that's what's troubling, I think, for many legislators, frankly, about the converse is true, I think, for the legislature in terms of, I think that there is some trepidation question as to really what the commissions really do. I mean, I will tell you, don't hold me to this, but I don't believe that I've been contacted really to any great extent by any of the commissions over the, this is my third session now, about any, I think the Women's Commission has contacted me about substantive issues that they were moving. I think the Hispanic Commission contacted me once during the time I've been a legislator, but I think that that's part of the frustration with the legislature, and part of the reason Representative Winters raises the question is, you know, by funding these commissions, if the original intent was to a great extent to be advocates for those communities and to provide an opportunity for the minority communities to step forward and to have their voice heard in the legislature, you know, how's that occur? I mean, I don't even know what the legislative agenda is this legislative session for the Black Affairs Commission, or for your commission, and, you know, the Commission on Black Affairs, or any of the other ones. I think the Women's Commission is the only one that I'm aware of as to what their legislative agenda is. Can you tell me, if we were able to fund you, how's the commission going to deal with that? How's that improved? What's the necessity for having the commissions if they're not coming to the legislature to be a voice, to raise the issues, to raise the questions? I don't remember. Did we hear from the commissions on the human services budget last time? I don't recall.
I came in and testified.
Okay.
And Gavry came in and testified.
Okay.
And
I might not have been there that day, so I don't...
Yeah. We participated to a large degree in the conversations individually as commissioners. As a commission as a whole, it's been difficult to get... one voice out of the commission. The situation I'm talking about is the legislators on the commission. The last time cycled around, they were talking about defunding the commissions. The legislators said that, well, we don't think that's fair. In fact, we think that's rather discriminatory and racist. And they said that they thought that they should let the legislators know. And I raised my hand and I said, well, what if I said that? What if I went to the legislator and I said, you know, your actions to defund these commissions is discriminatory and racist? They said, well, you couldn't say that. And around the room, it was consensus that I couldn't say that. And it's rather confusing to think that that can be said by a legislator, but it can't be said by a citizen or a commissioner without the consequences of you accusing somebody of being racist and discriminatory. And so that was the conversation we had in the context of the commission meeting that prevented any real direction being taken out of that commission meeting about addressing the issues of defunding, because I think that's a hot button and one that's sensitive, and the legislators in the commission said that, you know, you shouldn't raise that issue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
There's been two major issues surrounding the commissions. And one is trying to understand, one is if you're faced with an issue of having to prioritize within the state budget and you're looking at health and public safety, food and shelter, and it's not just the commission, because there's others that have been talked about defunding, and it's not just the advocacy groups. That's one issue. But I want to go back to a couple of other sessions when I came back into this building, and it's the same issue I posed today, and that is the overriding principles and what changes or change have occurred during the life of the commission. I came back into the building, and I personally worked with legislators in order to get your funding increase. And the discussion then was, if you give them more money, if you help get them into a direction, then they will be able to manage. That's been almost 6 years ago. And the questions, and then also the piece of that question, when the commissions were funded, they were given a dollar. I can remember my history correctly. They were given a dollar with the understanding that the commissions would, in fact, get involved with local fundraising issues and be able to somehow take and have other funding with the state funding. And you ask yourself the question, 23 years, that has not occurred. Now, I'm your mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and your mother's feeling very, very badly to have this kind of a conversation about something that she was involved with to assist to create, and having to ask these kinds of questions of what has occurred over the 23 years of state support. And I, you know, and so I'm kind of frustrated by it, because surely I sat here wanting the commission to succeed. And surely I think the notion of other funding, and I have met with the commission, and I've talked with the commission about with the issues that are out in the community, health is a huge issue, and that there are avenues to where you could get partners to assist you in educating the communities with respect to diabetes, with respect to hypertension, and some of those vehicles. And to date, the commission has done nothing. And I talked about the other day, and I gave you
the name.
But I gave previous ones. And so that's where the frustration is, Mr. Lake. It is where the legislature is saying, if we've got to make priorities, where do we make them? You know, not to say that the commission and this whole issue about what's happening in communities isn't valid, mm-hmm. but it's also what have been the results of the funding that we have given over the 23-year period of time. And I know that you've had turnover staff. I know those kinds of issues. But I still have to go back to what changes have occurred as a result of the work of the commission itself.
Well, again, I haven't been here the whole 23 years. Education in this community of Salem has changed specifically because of the work of the Commission on Black Affairs, the Latino Commission, and other community organizations that have partnered. There are community organizations now that are working, just pulled off a community conference with the school district and about 600 parents in the community. This all began with the efforts of the commission to address the issues of high dropout and suspension rate of particularly Black and Latino children in their school district. The Health Coalition in Portland is now ran by a former commissioner who sat with the commission during the development of that health coalition that's now working pretty vigorously to help address some of the health issues you mentioned. The successes, I think, in the communities have to be measured, I think, against the incredible challenge that exists for the commissions in working with these communities. these are, again, the least successful communities in the state. So when you look at the ability to raise funds from these communities, it should not surprise you that there's difficulty in raising funds from the same communities that we are attempting to lift up and raise.
But I guess my question is going to be, we all know that we're in a short funding cycle this time. We all know that money's tight. And I guess what I'm interested in, I get the sense Senator Winters and I think other people on the committee, you know, generally is, I understand the issue. I think we all understand to some degree the issues with the underrepresentation of minority communities in some specific areas. We understand a lot of those things. Would like to try and address those. But if we were able to fund you any money this legislative cycle, what would you do with it? How would you make a difference in the community? How do we compare that compared to throwing 130,000 people who receive direct services off the health plan? How do I resolve as a public safety chair dealing with that versus laying off state police officers or releasing felons into the local communities? That's what I'm interested in hearing. I know the rest of the advocacy commission people are here. What are you going? I mean, how do you provide the value-added piece, whether it be prevention, education, those kinds of things? And maybe we need to wait until Mr. Rice's testimony before the committee. But you know, I don't think there's people around this table who really wouldn't want to fund those as long as the compelling case was made that we're gonna, you know, that we can maybe tie some tangible benchmarks and pieces to that the actions that we would provide money for and the actions that you would take would make a difference.
Well, what the funding has allowed us to do is maintain a full-time executive director. Beyond that, the funding has not extended much further, and so the work of the commission has been defined often by the work of the executive director and the volunteer commissioners who are able to work on specific issues. Education has been, continues to be a primary concern for the commission, and so we have.
But can you tell us? I mean, can you articulate as the chair of the commission what are the goals of the commission? What are the primary focuses? You know, you've only had one executive director. What's the primary focus of the executive director, and how is that, and how the programs that you all as the commission appointed by the you're all appointed by the governor, I think, and approved by the Senate. What are the priorities that you've set? How have those priorities been carried out, and how has that made a difference to the community which you're asked to represent? I mean, I don't even, how many public hearings did you guys testify to during the last legislative session about programs and what were they? How many, you know, how many conferences have you participated in or been a part of or initiated? And how have those made a difference to the community? Those are the kinds of things, you know, that I think in this tight budget environment that we would need even to be able to stand up and support the commissions. We're cutting training, we're cutting advocacy, we're doing all these other things everywhere. It's not fun. And, you know, and I guess that's what I wrestle with, and that's what I'm hearing from Senator Winters as well.
Well, I'll come back. Education, as I said, is a primary consideration for the commission. And I personally probably have attended 50 different educational conferences across the state, encouraging success for African American students. Participated in a college visit program, created it, in fact, and defined it to promote college visits for African American students around the state, specifically with state institutions that have also contributed transportation or contributed a lunch for the kids and those kind of things to help them to be more successful in getting into college. Working with the NAACP on defining an after-school program that would help students to improve their academic performance so they can get into college. Without a actual list. I couldn't list specific places, but I can go from memory. U of O, OSU, Eastern Oregon, Western Oregon.
Let me interrupt you for a second, but I think the real issue is, I haven't looked ahead in this, but I don't know what are the goals of the commission? What are the goals of the limited resources of your executive director, and how are you trying to define, how's the commission trying to define those? If I only have X amount of resources for my business, I say, okay, these are the things we're going to put on top. I mean, I have a priority. We're asked to make a priority list. That's right. What each of the chairs, Senator Winters, myself, and Representative Butler have been asked. So I've sat down and made a priority list across agency lines for public safety.
Right.
And where do I cut that line? And what's justified? And there are lots of things at the bottom that I would love to provide. Oregon's Youth Challenge Program, which is specifically identified to do those kinds, to provide specific services for at-risk youth.
Right.
All those kinds of things.
That's
what I'm asking. And maybe Mr. Rice can.
No, we met specifically about zeroing in on significant issues and finding partners in the community to work with those specific issues. So we started a database with each issue detail, and also starting a list of the people that we want to call a community meeting with to help create a work group around those issues. We've tried to redefine commission meetings as work sessions rather than as meetings to get to the point of addressing the specific issues, but hoping to build some capacity again in the direction of the community so that the community finds the commission working on relevant issues that are important to them, and that is in the development stage.
I guess as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, but what I'm looking for is the commission set as its goal to have higher education for African-American students.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our number one goal for this biennium. And to do that, we toured the colleges. We tried to set up meetings with all the college presidents. We set so many programs in place as a result of the model that we worked on either individually or with the other commissions. Do you have anything like that?
Well, their college,
Mr. Russ wants to.
The college visit program, in fact, the partner who provides the transportation is the YWCA that provides the van. The NAACP has the structure for it because they have an education committee. And the Commission on Black Affairs has been a primary supporter of this effort. We have probably created visits for about 50 African-American children to probably 8 different state institutions.
Terry Winters, did you want to clarify?
Yes, I did. Maybe we're premature, but there is the benchmarks in the publication that talks to performance measures and outcomes, and they are listed as to what the agency's goals are and what the measurements are. So those are there.
Representative Johnson, I have a question.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I'm going to change the direction of the conversation, so if this piece isn't done, I'll wait.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
Mr. Chair, please, I was going to say I'm going to change the direction of the conversation slightly, so if this is a good departure point, I'll do that. If not, I'll wait.
And I apologize for not having been here, and then I'm looking at all these blank tabs in my book, and I beg your pardon. Representative Patridge, it sounds like the line of discussion has been along the priority list and the missions issues. Let's go ahead, Representative Johnson, with your question and dovetail it in right there.
My first session, last regular session, it now seems 300 years ago. But we heard the budgets of the advocacy commissions, and I come from a background of having raised a lot of money for a lot of good causes, and I think we had the conversation. I know I talked with Mr. Rice afterwards and was delighted to hear that he had fundraising expertise. I want to talk a little bit about what efforts have been made to raise money. Specifically, I think the advocacy commissions were all given the notice last session that they needed to raise $10,000 apiece to demonstrate community support. And I wanted to just follow up on, and I'll ask the same question to all of the advocacy commissions, what efforts were made to actually raise enough money to come back to the legislature and say people voted with their wallets that we're doing a great job and have that demonstration of good faith for the legislature?
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Please, please go right ahead. Get close enough to the mic there, please.
First of all, for the record, I am Everett Rice. I have the privilege of being the executive director of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. And good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Johnson. Basically, to answer your question, Mr. Johnson, we've had extensive work on fundraising. I can personally vouch for, if I may go back and digress a little bit, basically, state government has a very difficult problem of letting people know when they do a good job on something. I've been a state employee for 7 years, first working with the Department of Human Services. Even within the state legislature, I find that state government has a major problem in dealing with the things that it does right versus the things that they make mistakes on. Everyone knows when the Department of Human Services makes a mistake with a child. But you never hear about the thousands of cases where they do things right, where children's lives are saved, where children are pulled out of very desperate situations just in the nick of time where that child is not hurt, or in the worst case scenario, that child dies. So we live in a society, and being a former journalist, it's very easy to key off on the things that we don't do correctly. And the state of Oregon government has a wonderful way of not highlighting the things that it does do and it does do successfully. That's my personal soapbox. I hope you don't mind me mentioning that.
We get the same problem with the president.
Yes. One of the things that we try to do with the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs, I've had the honor of being the executive director for 2 years and 3 months. Having extensive experience in raising funds with public broadcasting and with the American Red Cross, ran into a very unique problem with working for a state agency and raising funds and that the public, and no matter how good you sell, no matter how good a salesperson you are for that organization, that people are reluctant to help fund a state agency that's getting funding from general fund. One of the major problems that the Commission on Black Affairs ran into, we have actually applied for 20 different grants with organizations who love the focus that we have, that love the idea that we are working for the implementation and establishment of social, legal, and political equality for blacks and African Americans in Oregon. And they applaud that idea. But the fact that we're not a 501c3 organization, that we're affiliated with state government, that 98% of all those grants were cut off right at the top. And we have, of course, it takes funds to become a 501c3 organization, and we're working on that. We have partnered with other organizations such as the African American Health Coalition. We have, I could go on and on and tell you about the things that the Commission on Black Affairs has done. Unfortunately, sometimes we work in obscurity, and we're not very good at telling our story and letting people know. One of my goals when I first came in as executive director was to make sure that people knew that the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs was here. I can guarantee you for a fact that as of this date, every library in the state of Oregon knows about the Commission on Black Affairs. There is information in every library in the state of Oregon that isolated African Americans and blacks throughout the state of Oregon in cities such as Bend and Pendleton and Mount Hood, or the 43 people in Mount Hood, which I did not know there were African Americans and blacks in Mount Hood, but in Klamath Falls and Medford, we have sought to connect with those communities and find out. Many of the legislators here in the state of Oregon were instrumental in helping me in that area. I basically visited every office, whether you, the senators and representatives of the state of Oregon, know it or not. I visited every office here in the state of Oregon. I left information on the Commission on Black Affairs. Many of you were so busy you weren't in your offices, but that was left with your staff. I can personally guarantee it because I was the person doing the footwork on that. And I can guarantee that in the last session and almost every session that we've had here in the last 2 years that that my face was one a lot of people saw here in the state of Oregon. But to answer your question, it's been difficult raising funds. That's one of those labor-intensive jobs that we have sought to do, but it's very labor-intensive. And to share a personal story with you on that, it has caused problems in my personal life, the fact that I'm out so much. I have literally spoken to over 60 different churches, African-American churches and churches here in the greater Portland, the greater Salem, the greater Eugene. I've personally spoken to the NAACP organizations in Salem and Corvallis in Eugene, with the Portland Urban League, with any organization that has a record of working with equal rights and working for the betterment of all Oregonians. Our office, I hate to go back to our office because our telephone is going to be full with people who need information about state of Oregon government. We let it be known early in the process when I came on board that the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs is here to serve the interests of the state of Oregon and to serve not only the legislature but the citizens of Oregon. And we've become kind of a referral source. We receive calls all the time from people all over the state of Oregon, and not just African Americans or blacks, but from all people regarding how they can solve problems with the state of Oregon agencies. You know, how do I get in contact with the governor's office? It may seem simple to us that people may not know how to go directly to the Internet and find the governor's information, but you'd be surprised how many people call our agency and say, look, I need the telephone number for the governor's office. I need to know someone to talk to make a complaint at DHS or with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And we've become that kind of resource. Some mornings I'm answering so many calls on my telephone where I can't even get to my regular work until 10 and 11 o'clock in the morning. And many of these things we do in obscurity because we have not done a good job of telling the legislature exactly what we do. And I could go on and on. I could take up the entire morning.
I'm trying to key off of something that Representative Patrick just brought up. I just left a meeting, and I apologize for coming late, but I just left a meeting of more anguished people in this building hunting for money. And I think as we move on through the session, that's going to continue. And in some cases, these people are coming literally running out of drugs, lives hanging in the balance. And it has been against that standard that I've tried to make judgments about where you draw the line as far as what can be funded. But in listening to you talk, trying to figure out and reason with you, how do you keep your important work alive without having redundancy? And without taking money away from people whose human services, and you worked in that department, so you know what I'm talking about, hanging the balance. Is there a mechanism that changes your model so that your work continues but the model's different? That you could be housed inside the NAACP or inside the Urban League, who are 501c3s and are not, as it appears you are, and I presume the same is the case for the other advocacy agencies, hobbled by the fact that you are a state agency. And I understand that foundations wouldn't give. Now, I do also know, looking out and seeing the Commission for Women, that the Commission for Women has raised money. And so I'm trying to figure out what distinguishes the Commission for Women that's been very successful in their advocacy and still it has the burden of being a state agency, and your mission. Ultimately, it's the value of the work conferred to folks that I think we're all applauding, but it's what model is it in? How have they been successful in raising money in a state agency, and you guys haven't, and I'm going to ask the same of the Hispanic and the Asian commissions. How successful have you been in raising private sector money? But if there's a different way to deliver the same valuable service and the general fund can be ransomed back to keep people in their homes or to keep people alive, that's the judgment call that all of us have to make. And I don't know whether your board has given any thought to another model that would keep the same services to African Americans, but without general fund underpinning it.
I can assure you that over the last 2 years, we have had people appear before the commission. We've had fundraisers appear, and it's one of those issues that we have considered very deeply and we've worked very hard on. I respectfully remember the fact that one of our first contributors was Representative Johnson, which I thank you in the letter for that. But we have many wonderful people who organizations, the church organizations here in Oregon reached out to the Commission on Black Affairs in a major way. Most of the fundraising that we did do came from churches all over the state of Oregon. And, of course, it wasn't the full $10,000, but it was a substantial amount to where we felt that we were making inroads.
How much do you think you raised?
I think we raised right around $1,300, which for an organization that before that raised very little. It was a major accomplishment for us. I literally spoke to, as I said, 60-something churches throughout the state of Oregon. But to answer your greater question, we have not told our story very good, and we haven't gotten the information about the things that the Commission on Black Affairs has done very well. We have literally, I forget the number, I wish I had the information here in front of me, but we have put our foot in, so to speak, many of the issues that faced you legislators. We've given written and verbal testimony before Senate and House committees, and we have been involved. And I guarantee you, if all of you check your offices, there is some information from myself and from the commissioners of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs.
One
last
follow-up. Yes.
I don't also in this environment want to discount how hard it's going to be to raise money. You talked about the faith community, and I think as there is a gradual withdrawal of state support across particularly the human services spectrum, that the pressure on charitable organizations and the faith community is going to rise. So I want to say that so you don't believe that I'm not mindful of it. But I also am acutely aware of the number of banks and utilities and folks that have stepped up and helped to support organizations that have received public money, including SEI in Portland and their longtime relationship with U.S. Bank. So I know that it can be done. I'm not saying it's not without a lot of hard work, but I know it can be done, too.
Representative Patridge, thank you.
And I guess that's, I mean, I think everyone all around this table's raised a lot of money. And a lot of people in the audience that we're probably looking at have raised a lot of money, too. But I'm still missing the disconnect from the original conversation that Representative Winters and I asked, and again, with a different spin on the follow-up with Representative Johnson. And I will tell you, I mean, listening to the Women's Commission, they came to my office, they have very articulated goals, programs, and things that they're trying to work on, as well as deal with the broader goals. And I'm still looking for that. I'm still looking for that. And as someone who contributes a lot to fundraising as
good,
well.
I make a note of that.
All right, you put that down. You know, but to articulate individual goal, I'm still missing, I still feel like there's a disconnect that I struggle with as a legislator. And I struggle with that not only for your fundraising part, but also for your pitch here to the legislature as to, you know, what's the focus and pitch as to what you're going to do with your, we fund the executive director position. Your executive director position, you're going to spend 30% of your time on public education. You're going to spend 20% of your time on these two or three program elements. I just am not, we're having a disconnect here, I feel like.
If I may, Representative, Mr. Chair, in your packet of information that was passed out to you, there is a list of ongoing and things that the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs is working on. That's a small list of the many things that we are working on.
Okay, well, I'll wait to your presentation. We kind of got off kilter a little bit.
And then finally, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I'm trying to look at is that when we went through those decisions in what's been referred to as the sixth special session, I tried to look for some alternative other than simply cutting off the funds for the commission. I wasn't particularly successful in that effort. But I looked for some ways that the commissions could at least continue to be partially funded. And I think what I'm looking for in this budget process for 2003-05 is to look for some alternatives that are different from the traditional way that they've been funded. That's not actually a statement in opposition to seeing general funds go to the commission. It's just a way to look at different ways that they could be funded and to look if there's any ways that we can continue the work of the commission. I'm going to use an analogy that I used a long time ago when I was at Metro, which isn't fair at first, and then I'll say why it's not fair. Metro has this range of services, and there were a number of people, and they actually won out in the end a little bit with this, is that they wanted Metro to get into the areas of affordable housing. They couldn't understand why I was opposed to them getting into affordable housing. It was because there were a multitude of agencies, including the state, Multnomah County, City of Portland, and everybody else, that had dozens of staff devoted to that purpose, and they wanted to put in a place two staff. And I said there's no way that two staff can actually accomplish very much in an issue so complex. And I could probably make that statement regarding the commissions, but the way that that would not be fair is there isn't anybody else doing this work on the outside. So even though you only have one staff member, I can't really make the argument that that somebody else is doing this work, because I don't really think that somebody else is doing this work. But I share Representative Johnson's frustration in the sense that I know how difficult it's going to be to get general fund dollars for some items this time. And I'm making more of a statement, Mr. Chairman, than a question. But I also want to get away from this analogy that we always use between general fund dollars to keep people alive and comparing that to every expenditure we make with general fund dollars. Because if it's the clear statement of somebody gets this benefit or they're not here in 90 days, I think then it's kind of a tight line. That might make up, who knows, 10% of the general fund, 5% of the general fund. You can start to make analogies, or you can start to say that a state trooper that doesn't get to an accident scene because there are not enough state troopers out there, that a person could die. You could say that a young individual who's committed a juvenile offense because we don't provide the services to him could end up involved. You can stretch the thing almost as far as you want to stretch it. You can say a third grader that doesn't get the right education may end up in, you know, not fulfilling themselves in school and may end up in other activities that ultimately result in something very negative. But what I'm looking for here is some alternatives, and I wanted to impress upon the commission, each one of the commissions, that I think that they're going to need to approach. This is only my personal perception, Mr. Chairman. I haven't talked to all five members of it. They're going to need to come up with some alternative mechanisms to get through this process in 03-05 in order to remain funded. One of those might be, and I'm not suggesting this is the only one, is what would happen if we moved you out into a 501(c) and gave you some level of support in general fund dollars. That's not an abnormal thing. We do give grants out to people in general fund dollars, which might put you in a different position in terms of advocacy for the commission. There probably are three or four different alternatives, at least, of how things could be done. But I just want to impress upon you that the way this budget looks, I think that the commissions are going to have to present alternatives, and I might get your reaction to that.
And if I could, Senator Winters, you were here when these advocacy commissions started, or where a group of them started. Would that be inconsistent with the original intention?
No, the original intent, and I stated earlier when you were here, Mr. Chair, is that we actually gave them a dollar, and that was with the intent that they would go out and secure the funding. I do want to follow up on a point that Reverend Johnson raised, and which Mr. Rice responded of the difficulty because they weren't a 501(c). And my question is the Women's Commission a 501(c)? Because actually they do receive other funds. And if that barrier isn't there for them, why is the barrier there for the other advocacy commissions? And I would like to have either staff or someone to come back to us and explain that particular dynamic, because I think that would be very helpful for this body.
Senator Winters, I'm not an attorney. Two members, at least two members, have been trained in the law. However, 501 is a
it's a nonprofit
IRS code status that deals with nonprofit. it also could be imputed that contributions to a municipal agency, which is a 190 under the Oregon Revised Statutes, qualify for charitable deduction or charitable contribution under the Internal Revenue Code. So, but I do, my understanding, and Representative Johnson is, has a lifetime in the field of raising for charitable foundations, I do understand that those that are qualified under the 501 section of the Internal Revenue Code do have a greater opportunity to reach out because they do not have the affiliation that an Oregon 190 would have, and there are certain amounts of taint, if you will, that come with that close association of the 190 that maybe an organization would have as opposed to the 501, which would be organized for its charitable and alienationary, help me.
I love that word.
Anyway, charitable purposes that are organized under the Internal Revenue Code. So I guess the concern that I would have is that and Representative Johnson, you've seen this in many instances, I'm sure, that if they have that close association under Section 190 of the Oregon Revised Code versus a completely independent charitable nonprofit status under 501, one of the sections of 501, where C1, 5, whatever, on down the list, and even educational organizations are listed under the 501 section, but recognizing that the Oregon University systems are all under Section 190 of the Oregon Code. But it makes them, they have within them then the ability to go ahead and organize the 501 corporations. Representative Johnson, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, but I'm going to do it in kind of an oblique way, Mr. Chair. Okay. I was just thinking, listening to Senator Devlin's comments about looking at a different model and thinking about what you were saying in terms of how the absence of a 501c3 hampers a number of institutions that are trying to raise money. There are models that I'm aware of in this building, OPB being one of them. I was on Oregon Public Broadcasting's board when they came in the 92 session and said, release us from being a state agency, allow us to go out and form as an entrepreneurial, nimble 501c3 foundation at the time. Now the foundation's gone, but that's another story for another time. But they asked for that release, and they said, give us a model whereby we can get enough of a settlement to get a running start on our new life, and we won't come back. And that's what happened. Now, they haven't quite cut the umbilical cord, but the model is there. And I don't know whether or not, as we move through this budget cycle, you guys could come back with some kind of a budget that said, give us enough money to let us go. And I'm saying this, I can see representatives from the other commissions, and we'll have the same conversation. But give us enough money to let us go and form as a 501 and go off and do good with private money rather than public money.
Thank you very much.
And I know, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, a charitable board I sit on takes a pretty hard look at making contributions to government-supported entities. It's not that we don't do it, but it's prioritized lower than other stuff. But were you given the opportunity, all the commissions given the opportunity to form as independent, standalone charitable organizations, I think that might enhance your fundraising based on the example that you just gave where 98% of your requests were denied given your government status.
Representative Senator Winters?
Just to follow, as you move towards that process, I still would like the question answered with respect to how the Women's Commission, you know, if they have a 501c status, or how are they able to generate the other funds that come into their budget. And I so that if there are some other methods out there that the other commissions will can benefit from what they are doing and how they are doing it. Because they truly are, you know, if I look at their other funds category, that they're raising money from some source and they're getting it in somehow. I
And I just like to have a response from that commission as to how they're able to do that.
I just thought about the fundraising question, because the Latino Commission was able to raise funds through teaching Spanish language skills for state workers. I don't know if they're still able to do that, but that was something that the Women's Commission could not do, you know, because it's a peculiar niche. And I think some of the women's resources are a little different than what the Black community may have access to, or the Latino community. And so I think the possibilities have to be looked at as well, in searching through the communities of color. It's often difficult to find even successful businesses that can leverage some of their funds to support a commission without something in return. I mean, if I'm going to hand you a dollar, I need to know that I'm getting something back for that dollar, and it needs to be something usually that's supportive and helpful to my business, not just feel good, nice to help the commission. And that piece, I think, is something that takes time to develop those relationships with businesses and the community.
I would say this relative to the Hispanic affairs. We did go ahead and ask that funds be raised from the outside, but they could not be raised from another state agency. And that was one of the things that the Hispanic Affairs had done, was to adopt a contract for teaching Spanish to state agencies previously. And we said, that's a good thing to do, but we want you to raise $10,000 or more from the outside. Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing I did want to ask the executive director about in terms of looking at alternatives is this issue that came up earlier about whether particularly the advocacy commissions like Hispanic Affairs, Black Affairs, and the Asian Affairs, whether it might be possible for them to do their activities more closely together than being entirely distinct. Because I'm trying to think about what your day must be like. Maybe you can give me a reaction to that. Is if you're a one-person office, that means, I mean, you're returning all the calls. You obviously have to set up agendas for your commission. You probably have to, you know, the ability to actually have the mass to be able to actually go out and affect change. It's pretty hard when you're a one-person office. Can you give me some reaction to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, the last 2 years and 3 months with the commission have been some of the most rewarding of my life, and have also been some of the most draining physically of my life. I wanted to share this with the committee that because of my extensive work schedule, 4 months during the summer, my doctor put me on disability leave. It can be that trying. I made it an effort when in my first testimony before this commission 2 years ago, during the 2001-2003 biennium, I mentioned to the committee that whatever job I go into, I bring 100% and 110% to that job. I've done that with my job here at the commission, and it is a very hectic day. It's a very hectic day. I happen to live in the city of Portland. But I try to attend as many meetings as I can here in Salem, and not counting Eugene, not counting Corvallis, and I try to be there for the community that I serve. I take the job of serving the state of Oregon and serving our communities very seriously. I have some wonderful commissioners who help out and who are dynamic people, and who I thank my chair so much for his efforts on my behalf. He carries a lot of the load in speaking for the commission and attending meetings throughout the community. And it has been very difficult, but it can be very taxing. And I found out the hard way that if you don't learn how to pace yourself in a correct way, that a hospital will pace you in ways that you desire not to. But you know, the fundraising aspect, the advocacy of communities aspect, the attending community meetings, the lobbying of legislators, and these are all very labor and time intensive jobs. And it can be sometimes when I got home in the evenings, I knew for a fact that I worked a full day.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to comment too that
I mean, I've been involved with a number of nonprofits, and one in particular that I was involved with, now it's, this is the is a small group called the Tualatin River Keepers, actually, which is sort of an educational group. They started out probably more than a decade ago, but I was involved, six, 7 years ago. And they started off with a part-time executive director and a part-time clerical person. For years, all they had is volunteers. I think now they have 4 full-time staff. And they're all supported by grants, and they've been very effective. And that's a relatively small environmental organization. Now it's true that they have different grant to be able to go out for too, which is kind of the thing. And I didn't know how to comment about this at Keep It. I think a difference between the advocacy commissions, other than the Women's Commission, the obvious, you know, undeniable difference about the Women's Commission is women represent about 51% of the residents of the state. So I would assume that their fundraising capability should be pretty significant.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cueing off of Senator Devlin, I've had conversations with, I know Roslyn, and I don't recall whether or not we talked about it, Mr. Rice, but the possibility of a what I call a shared back room that would have common clerical, common receipt of donations, common mailing. Those functions don't change across the subject area. If you're receiving a gift, you receive it the same way. And in some cases, that was economies could be achieved. In others, they couldn't, because I think it is, Rosin, you are rent-free, and I shouldn't direct that to somebody in the audience, but I think that some of the commissions exist in free space, some exist in rental space. Some are in they're at great distance physically. And so at least we've explored the concept of could you have a combined back room. And there are some barriers. I don't know how surmountable or insurmountable in the long run, but we've talked about it.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, for that observation. Now, colleagues, we have about 25 minutes to go, and we need to go ahead and get Mr. Rice's presentation and Satish's follow-up from Budget and Management, and then we've got some public testimony. So Mary Lou has signed up. So. Eric, do you want to give us the 30,000 foot level and hit the top of the mountains for us, and then we'll move on?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Basically, I'll give you the shortened version of basically 8 years ago. I moved 8.5 years ago to the state of Oregon from Memphis, Tennessee. I was very impressed with the fact that Oregon cared enough, and that there was a visionary by the name of Governor Vic Atiyah and those who work with him, as our own Senator Winters. In creating the Commission on Black Affairs and having the forethought to recognize that a state being as large as the state of Oregon, that you can easily overlook the 1.6% of the population that's African-American or black. I applaud that concern that the governor and those surrounding the governor had for this small community. And they recognize that as a community that small, the needs and issues of that community can be easily overlooked. I wanted to encourage the legislature and the committee this morning that I realize that you're making very difficult decisions as regards funding, as regards health care, as regards all the issues that you as lawmakers have to vote on. I'm going to encourage you also to look at the commissions, the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs, but all the commissions as an investment for the future. I had the opportunity of speaking to the Rotarians last month in Memphis, the downtown Memphis Rotarians, and it was during Black History Month. One of the things they asked me is, how can we be a better state? And my answer to them was to recognize the individual needs of each and every Oregonian and the communities that they represent. While we are all equal, we are all not the same. There are issues that affect the African-American and black community that are very unique and very different to that community that may not affect the larger community or may not affect the Native American or the women's community or the Hispanic community. And I think that the commissions are the conduit for the governor's office and for you, the legislators, to know about those issues and to act proactively on those issues. I hope that the commissions will still be here. I realize that you have very difficult decisions. And as a state employee, I'm not supposed to say this, but know that you'll be in my thoughts and prayers in making these decisions, because I know they're very hard. I don't envy you. I would not want to be in your chair. But I think that the having done this job for the last 2 years, I know that it's a very important job, that the people's knowledge of the commissions are increasing every day, that people are starting to realize that the commissions are there for the benefit of not only the communities they represent, but for all Oregonians. You know, when someone calls and needs information about state government, I don't ask them whether they're African American or black. I serve their needs, and whether it's a housing problem, whether it's a DHS problem, whether it's a state government problem, they need to talk to the governor's office or their legislature. I'm going to serve the needs of those people they call. I encourage you to look closely at the commissions. That we have done some great things. Are there things we can do better? Yes. Always things we can do better. But we haven't always done a good job in letting you know the things we've done, letting you know the communities that we have affected in a positive way, the individuals that we have affected in a positive way. And in these very difficult fiscal times, a time period when we're facing, when we have young men and women on the battlefield in a faraway land, that we need the input of Oregon's diverse communities. And the commissions, whether it's the Black Commission, the Hispanic Women's, or the Asian Commission, I think that their input to the governor and to you, the legislators, is extremely important. And I encourage you during this very difficult time to work with us to keep funding there. And also, in closing, I'd like to say that this is not a plea for my job. As of April 1st, I am out of a job, but I intend to keep working on the issues that affect African Americans and blacks and all Oregonians, and I will be here to serve your needs and interests in any way possible. And but I didn't want this to appear to them. I'm pleading for my job. No. But I think the commissions are just that important to where they need to exist in the 2003 through 2005 biennium. Now, thank you for
taking time. Thank you very much, Chair. And budget management, Satish?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Satish Pavia, Department of Human Services. We're going to talk to you about the governor's budget for the commission of taxpayers. If you turn to page 2 of my presentation, document.
Page 2.
The budget consists of $181,602 approval fund. This is a 15% increase from the 2001-2008 in the approved budget to the fifth special session. Over 3/4 of the increase is due to the cost of living adjustment approved during the 2001-2003 biennium, anticipated increase in the cost of retirement and health benefits, and cost to fund the 2003-2005 merit increase. And if you return to the pie chart,
the pie chart on page 3 shows that over 88% of the commission's budget is general fund and about 12% is other funds. During the various special sessions we've had, the agency's budget has been reduced. During the second special session, there was a reduction of $1,836 general fund, which is a 2% reduction from the legislatively approved budget. And during the fifth special session, there was another reduction of $5,170 general fund. During the third special session, there was an increase of $4,413 general funds for employee compensation adjustments. The governor's budget, it enables the agency to continue existing operations. It provides $160,194 general fund, which pays for the executive director position and other operating costs, and this is mostly state government service charges. And it also assumes that the agency will receive donations to cover $21,449 expenditures in other funds. The budget, 79% of the budget is personal services and 21% is services and supplies. I'm now on page 6. How was the budget developed? The 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget consisted of $161,562 total funds. During the second special session, we include the reduction in the $1,836 of general fund. And there's also a base budget adjustment, roll-up of the 2001-2003 position actions and compensation changes. This is an increase of $15,646 general fund. This would be coming down based on the decision not to provide the cost of living adjustments. And package 010 provides adjustments for mass transit taxes. Package 030 provides standard inflationary increases for inflation and state government service charges. There are two policy packages. Package 091, this includes the reduction taken during the fifth special session. When it's finalized, would be $10,702 general fund and a reduction of 0.11 full-time equivalent position. Now, this again gets restored in package 092. So the governor's budget basically keeps the agency's budget whole. If you have any questions?
Any questions of Mr. Upadhyay? Satish, just one question relative to the, let's see, it's down page 6. Come back a few pages. Page 4. $21,449 other funds expenditure for additional donations. The write-up through February indicated that the Commission for Black Affairs has raised $200 in donations to the 0103 biennium through February. Is there some specific amount that the Commission for Black Affairs was going to raise $21,000, which would be a 100-fold increase of where we were at through February?
Mr. Chair, during the governor's budget development period, I did have a conversation with the commission. I have the same concern as how the commission was going to raise this $21,000. I did hear from the former commission chair, Frank Thompson, that the commission would be accelerating its fundraising efforts and that they were pretty confident that they would be able to raise this amount of funds.
Okay. You've heard the recommendation from legislative or from the budget department budget and analyst, budget management analyst. Are there questions for Mr. Upadhyay? Thank you very much, Satish. We do have, do you want to give your recommendation now or should we wait for public testimony?
That would be a work session.
Okay. Why don't we just wait then for you at work session then? And I'm going to go ahead then. Thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate you being here, Mr. Schlake and Mr. Rice. Thank you, Mr. Badia. And we have Mary Lou Cornejo. And again, I apologize to all of you present. I went over and watched the bill of mine get trashed, so. It's a jobs creation bill, and I want to get some kind of a jobs creation bill. And Senator Deckard probably has the best jobs creation bill, and I hope we'll get a chance to hear it. So with that, I come down with a pretty bad bruised backside this time. So
a lot of bruising going on.
Yeah, a lot of bruising. Right, yeah, anything that's got a fiscal on it is getting squashed. So, Ms. Cornejo, please.
Good morning, and that's chair. I don't know who's the chair, but who chairs this committee. Okay, good for you, Representative Butler and Senator Winters and the rest. My name is Mary Lou Cornejo, and I'm a Black Affairs Commissioner. I have been a Black Affairs Commissioner for the past 2 years, 3 years. You lose count because, for me, it's a special commission near and dear to my heart. My family is what you would call a family of the millennium. We have hit everyone on the spectrum. So when I look at my nieces, and I think one of the biggest impacts, and I'll state this real quick, because I believe in I'm a visual person, and you have to look at how things roll out sometimes. And I remember when my kids were young, and I took them to the Mount Angel Oktoberfest. And, you know, little kids are standing in line waiting to buy a hot dog. And so there's four of them. And in my family, they're varied in color also. And so their cousins were with them who were half African American. And the lady that was in front gave my children cuts in the line. And she did not give cuts to my nieces that were there at the time. Afterward, I pulled my children aside and I said, you know, you are one. You are one because you are cousins. You know, you should love one another, but this is not right. How come you took cuts when, well, the lady gave us cuts. Well, how about your cousins? Well, she didn't give him cuts. Well, needless to say, we had a big old conversation over that piece and what it should look like in our family. That example and many more brought me to the Black Affairs Commission because I began to see the injustice in the system itself. I'm a veteran of 24 years in the Oregon Army National Guard, and I saw the injustice. I saw a female soldier who died, African-American, and was not given the same burial rights as someone else. That spoke to me even then. So when this opportunity to serve on this commission came up, I jumped on it. And you had some very good questions. This is a tough budget period. I'd hate to be there when I've seen. I was there not too long ago when you have people that are hurting and suffering and we have to do a better job. You know, Senator Winters, when you asked, you know, how come these commissions? You know, it's been 23 years. Well, you know, civil rights was a while ago, and we still haven't gotten there. And we have to always be cognizant of that, that if something is growing, it's going to take time. It's not an overnight venture. It's a stretching of comfort zones. It's a stretching of reference frames for everyone involved. When we talked about the Women's Commission, that's another near and dear commission to my heart, and talked about the fundraising. How come they were able to? Well, you know, as a woman, I'm a Latina, and I can relate to that commission. Why? Because I'm a woman, and I might have a little more money. Their issues might impact me because I'm a mujer. But guess what? If you're an African-American person, how many can speak to that example? How many can have a buy-in into that? Not a whole lot. And what about the economic power of those few? How about the economic power of bringing in people who want to do the right thing, but they see things like, there's so much more suffering here, there's so much more suffering there. And you're right. I'm a firm believer that if something doesn't work, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You say, darn it, we've got to restructure. We've got to look at this one more time. You asked some very good questions of this commission. I was sitting there back there fidgeting, thinking, I chihuahua, let me up there because I've seen some of the things that we have done. You know, this is an advocacy commission. That means that just one person, and we're volunteers in the process, for God's sake. That's another piece here. You know, that we're going to serve only on the time frames that we have to be able to help impact. That's number one. But as a restructuring tool, maybe we can have a little bigger impact. But I want to say that I hold the legislative piece responsible, too. I sit back there and I'm pissed. Excuse me. I'm mad. And let me tell you why I'm mad. Because we have legislators to this commission who should be serving in roles that say, okay, I'm going to mentor you along. I'm going to help. I'm going to help this commission. Let them know what the legislative piece is saying, some of the language that they're speaking, so you can look at us and say, okay, how do we help you in this process? Some of that was not done. Senator Duncan, bless his heart, was a mainstay in that commission on the time I served. We had another representative who maybe showed up four times. Four times. Where's the accountability factor there? You know, you want accountability from us, but we need accountability here across the board.
Apparently these were legislators that were commissioners?
No, they were assigned to the commission, yes.
As legislative representatives?
Right.
Okay. Ex officio, then.
Well, actually, they are in the commission structure. We do appoint one member from the House, and there's a member from the Senate that is appointed to serve on the commission.
On each commission?
I know it is okay. The Black Affairs Commission. Yes. I assume it is all the other commissions, and that then allows for that member to go back to the respective chambers to advocate and to provide that communication link, if you will, between the commission and
that should be a mentoring.
Do we know the House and Senate presently?
It was Representative Minnis at one time. And that's the one that I hardly ever saw. I mean, maybe she went 5 times, and maybe her work schedule was different. But if you want a commission to succeed, we need that mentoring piece.
And Senator Duncan was also in attendance.
Correct, okay. Correct.
After his retirement, do you know if there's anyone appointed there?
I don't know what the Senator Duncan has been a member of that commission for some time.
He has, for
a lot of years. And I don't know, and I can check with the Senate President to see if there has been a member that's been appointed.
Mr. Rice, you want to just, for the record, tell us who has taken the places of the two previously in there?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to speak. We currently have requests for a new Senate representative and a new House representative there. Those requests have been in since November of 2002.
Okay. No one has been appointed to your knowledge?
No, sir, not as yet.
They haven't even got the bathroom passes printed over on the Senate side, so it may yet. Thank you very much. Please continue, Mary Lou.
And I guess I see the role of that House person and that Senate person to see that should be your accountability back to you to say, wait a minute, you know what, you guys, what was the charter here? What were you supposed to be doing? Let's stay on, you know, help stay the course. That, in my opinion, did not happen other than Senator Duncan, who tried, bless his heart. He's the one. But that's another piece that speaks to me that says, yes, there's a difference here in commissions. I want to say I think it would be great if we could all roll into one and speak as one voice and go that one path. But guess what? We're not there yet. We are not there yet. The issues that impact the Women's Commission are different from the issues that impact the African American community. And wish it were that, you know, that you could do a one shoe fits all, or one size dress fits all for these commissions, and I'm sorry, but it most certainly doesn't. It most certainly doesn't. We have a large, growing Asian community who are yet to flex their muscles and speak. You know, as I think right now, the Black Affairs Commission has such potential, not just for the sake of existing to exist. That's wrong. That should be checked right out the door. It should be for the sense of providing service to the state of Oregon and for everyone as a community, not just because you happen to be African American, you're going to get special treatment, because believe me, when I was in the military, that's the first thing I heard. Oh, Hispanic Month is coming. That's your month. You know, why isn't it my month as an American, period? Why isn't it all our months as an American? We deserve that. Every single one of us deserve that. So I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but I do want to say that I love this commission. I will advocate as much as I can because we have a voice that is growing in the winds of change, but the deficits are so much larger than that voice. And there's that needed voice to say, wait a minute, this is wrong. Our children deserve better. They deserve to be at the seat at the table. They deserve to speak with that voice. They deserve to exist with dignity and respect. And to point today, it's not there yet. We're not there yet. We're trying, but we're not there yet. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Cornejo, Senator Weyers?
Yeah. Secretary.
You touched on something, and I asked it earlier, and I'm going to go back to it, because both you and I are very universal, because I call myself Heinz 57. and I remember, particularly now, given the limited resources that exist, and I, just as Representative Johnson talked about, maybe ways of doing things different, maybe ways of sharing among the groups, and I'm going to go back. And I know that often each group wants to have their own identity, but as we move towards the bigger picture, it lends itself to universalism. It lends itself to where we're all talking about we are one member on this planet.
But we're not there yet.
But we're not. But I'm asking the question, can the commissions come together to share some? I mean, I'm looking at the limited resources. I'm looking at the issue that Representative Johnson threw out there of maybe different kinds of configurations to keep the commission viable. And I just throw that out there. I know we had discussed this some 20-some years ago of whether or not you could, particularly, let's say, for example, the education issues are issues that all of the groups share and have problems with. Mm-hmm. The issue of economic growth, it's an issue that all of the entities. If I look at health truly is an issue that all of the groups share. And are there some commonalities that exist among the groups that the groups can work together on? You know, I'm just looking at ways of...
I agree with you. I think, Jackie, that if... I hope you don't mind me calling you, okay? I think, Jackie, that what could happen, and maybe, let me regress just a hair. Right now, Oregon State University, I work for them as a Latino Outreach Coordinator for 4-H. Oregon State University is getting together some great minds. And thank God they got me in there. So great minds, remember this, because that's what it's going to take. Free thinkers, people who will come together and say, can this commission exist in a different way? I think you're right. I think all have health issues, all have economic development issues, education issues that are a big impact. But you have to realize, Jackie, too, that while they share all these commonalities, the percentages are the ones that are the biggest impact. Because then you're going to be saying, wait a minute. Yes, right now in the criminal justice system, we have Latino, African American, and Native American who are our biggest contributors. Okay, by that piece alone, there should have been a cohesive piece, like you said, certain strands that come together to impact that. But they cannot do that without money, without resources. And you know that as well as I do. You know that as well as I do. Then you can give me a special heading. Here, you go forth, Cornejo, and procreate, whatever. You go down that line. More members, sorry. You go down that road, okay? But if you don't have the resources behind you, if you don't have the leadership that it's going to take to help you along that continuum, how far do you think I'm going to get? I'm going to be like Everett, you know, pretty soon having health issues because you're so darn stressed that you cannot even begin to think about it. So to end... And I thank you for being patient with me. I'm looking at your body language. To end this, I'm still saying, yes, there can be a model, but there better be people at the table who will be able to create this model. And if there is, I don't see it happening for at least another two good sessions, you know, before you can begin to gather the things that you need or the people in place that you need to be able to create this model.
Thank you, Ms. Cornejo. Other questions for Ms. Cornejo? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Others, we just had you sign up, Ms. Cornejo. We're out of time. With that, we're going to go ahead and continue to hear the advocacy commissions tomorrow, and then we will receive information from Legislative Fiscal. With that, we're going to go ahead and close this until even time tomorrow. Thank you very much.